New in August, a record number of migrant families stream across the U.S.-Mexico border. We talk to Catholic Charities and a bishop on the front lines of the immigrant influx.
We're 7 hours north of the U.S.-Mexico border here in Dallas, Texas, along a major corridor that opens up to the rest of the country. As immigration is debated, what is the real-life impact of policy, and how does the Catholic Church respond? I'm Mark Irons with that story coming up.
You're not alone. There's support out there, and we can help you with safe options for you and your baby.
An uptick in the use of safe haven laws for mothers with unplanned pregnancies is saving young lives. And highlights from the Pope's mission to Mongolia. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
The Catholic Church is very firm for the last 2,000 years that immigrants are to be welcome, because in the scripture the Lord tells us once you were immigrants yourselves.
A surge in immigrant families coming across the U.S.-Mexico border spurs discussion yet again. What is the most humane way to treat migrants once they've entered the country? What's the responsibility of federal, state, and local governments? And what's our responsibility as Catholics to welcome the stranger while securing our borders? Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The topic of illegal immigration is one of the most divisive topics in America today. But despite vast disagreements on how to address the issue, most people seem to agree on this assertion: the immigration system is broken. And new data from last month shows families crossing illegally into the U.S. has reached an all-time high. Preliminary numbers from the U.S. Border Patrol indicate at least 91,000 migrants who crossed as a family group were arrested in August, exceeding the prior one-month record of nearly 85,000 set in May of 2019. The August tally brings the total number of family member units surrendering at the southern border to more than 500,000 people this fiscal year. That is a record, with one more month left to count. Major increases this summer in migration from Guatemala, Honduras, Ecuador, Peru, and some African and Asian countries have presented humanitarian, linguistic, and logistical challenges for the Border Patrol. The August surge came during peak summer temperatures, with desperate migrants crossing hot, desert areas.
For Tucson sector, we're rescuing thousands of people this year to date. Those rescues go up during the summer months because of the heat. Unfortunately, there are folks who don't make it. And just during this summer alone, we've already had dozens of migrants die out in the desert who have succumbed to heat exhaustion.
But despite the many dangers, the family groups keep coming, often relying on smugglers' promises that families are less likely to be deported. All of this begs the question of respect for human life. How can migrants be treated in a civilized way while respecting the immigration laws of the U.S.? And how do we confront the immigration crisis from a Catholic perspective? In a moment, we'll talk to leaders from Catholic Charities in two large northern cities in the U.S. dealing with a massive influx of refugees into their communities. And from the U.S.-Mexico border, the Catholic Bishop of El Paso. But first, we begin our team coverage with reporter Mark Irons in Dallas, Texas.
He just felt the need to immigrate.
Father Ignacio Alvera knows an immigrant struggle. He grew up poor in Mexico. The youngest of eight children, his father was a farmer. To eat, the family relied on crops, which depended on rain. But during dry seasons, feeding the family wasn't possible.
There was no food.
There was no food for the family to feed, so he had to, go out.
With his father migrating first in search of a better life for his children, the rest of the family eventually followed, ending up in Dallas, Texas. Among U.S. cities, it has one of the highest populations of Hispanic migrants.
I came when I was about 17, 18 years old from Mexico.
And now, a priest at St. Cecilia Parish, Father Alvera wants to support the people who have made the same journey he has.
The church, as an institution, is here to care for them and to be a community, to offer a community for them.
He acknowledges immigration can be a contested issue in America.
If America is as big and as great as we all, believe it is, anybody should be able to come over here.
There's also people looking to exploit, the whole situation.
If they want to be here, they need to live as an American and follow
the rules.
From people on the streets to politicians, the opinions and policy debates will go on. But the reality remains. Millions of immigrants live in the U.S. right now. And Father Ignacio says Christians have been given a mandate to help those in need.
And this doesn't have to be political. There is nothing political about helping another human brother or sister to lend a hand.
Christian teaching on the responsibility of nations and those who migrate can be found in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It indicates political authorities must care for the common good of the people in their country. So a country would have a right to establish laws and protect its borders. But it states the more prosperous nations are obliged, to the extent they are able, to welcome the foreigner in search of the security and the means of livelihood which he cannot find in his country of origin. At the same time, immigrants have a duty to their new country. The Catechism continues, immigrants are obliged to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey its laws, and to assist in carrying civic burdens. Enforcing law and order at the U.S. southern border continues to be a problem. Illegal border crossings reportedly reached a record high number last month.
The situation is a disaster. It's unsustainable. It's creating emergencies all across the country.
Ira Melman is the media director for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He believes the U.S. immigration system is broken.
What we should be doing is deterring people. The best form of law enforcement is deterring people from violating laws in the first place.
But some of the methods used in the policy debate over immigration can be problematic. At least that's how it has been described by some U.S. Catholic bishops. Politically conservative governors in Texas and Florida have supported the transportation of migrant asylum seekers living in the U.S. to politically liberal cities around the country. In response, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, has said, if they're transporting them to make a statement, then that seems to me to be problematic. Bishop Mark Seitz of the Diocese of El Paso adds, it does seem clear that they were being used not out of concern for the migrants, but in an effort to make a political point. In different ways, immigration will continue to impact America and the Catholic Church. Demographics are tracked by the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate. In 2021, its analysis showed 34% of Catholic adults in the U.S. were Hispanic. That number could grow.
As the U.S. Catholic Church increasingly becomes a church filled with migrants, they're bringing their Catholic faith with them, not only to the churches, but to the communities they live in.
That's the case in Dallas, Texas, says Father Olvera, especially here in the trendy Bishop Arts District, where you can see a symbol of Catholic faith and immigrant inspiration painted in bright colors.
Which represents all the Latinos and all the Hispanics that live here in the neighborhood.
The Virgin Mary, Mother of God, depicted as Our Lady of Guadalupe, is popular not only in Mexico, but throughout the world.
What does the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe bring?
Oh, she's our mother. She's the mother of all of us. So the image of motherly love for all of us who sometimes struggle or have conflicts or have problems in our families or jobs.
A mother for all people on any side of a border. And last year, during a procession here in honor of Our Lady of Guadalupe, Father Ignacio says within the crowd, he saw something special.
The image of what the Catholic Church is, universal. You know, there is this diversity, but at the same time, there is this unity. So I think our faith is what bonds us, is what brings us together, whatever background we may be, whatever race we may be.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
We see successful community integration in Mark's story, yet the influx of immigrants has sparked alarm and talk of crisis in cities across the country. Multiple border cities have declared states of emergency, including El Paso, Texas, and San Diego, California. But northern areas of the country are also declaring states of emergency after busloads of migrants were sent there, including Massachusetts, the state and city of New York, and Chicago. We spoke with the Associate Vice President of Community Impact with Catholic Charities in Chicago about helping migrants get housing.
What we're working on in the immediate is we're working on connecting folks who are in City of Chicago run shelters with housing, with permanent housing. So we've been doing that work since December 2022. This is a unique program in the City of Chicago and the state of Illinois to provide 6 months of rental assistance. So that those funds are not being provided by Catholic Charities, they're being provided by the state of Illinois, which really has been crucial in helping families get resettled. Every month, trying to achieve the goal of 500 households finding permanent housing. We're not quite there yet, and so that's where we need the support of community partners.
The Vice President of Refugee and Immigration Services for Catholic Charities in Boston, Marjean Perhot, joins us now to talk about what she's seeing on the ground there. Thank you so much for joining us, Marjean. Tell us about the crisis in Boston. What led to the declaration of a state of emergency that you were forced to respond to?
Well, thank you very much for reaching out to us here in Boston. I'm happy to talk about the housing situation crisis that has allowed Catholic Charities the opportunity to increase its work that we do with providing shelter to new arrivals and residents who have been part of the Commonwealth their whole lives. So in the summer, the governor of Massachusetts, Maura Healey, did declare a state of emergency for a housing crisis that we have. Or the crisis is not a migrant crisis. The crisis is a housing crisis. We do not have enough housing, affordable housing stock here in Massachusetts. And our shelters for emergency shelter for people that are in need of housing were becoming extremely full. And the state of emergency allowed for some more resources to be opened up to help serve those who are in most need.
And what is it like for your team on the ground? What conditions are people arriving in or are you dealing with? And do you have enough supplies and team members to help them?
Well, the situation on the ground is definitely very dynamic and changes frequently. What Catholic Charities has been able to do is stand up a brand new emergency shelter whereby we are serving 45 families that are comprised of an average of about four people per family. And so our shelter is being run out of a former hotel. So we were able to get that shelter up and running within 3 weeks of being asked by the government to help out with the situation. And the families are coming, most of them, about 80% are new arrivals to the U.S., mostly from Haiti and some from South America. And most are coming just with a small bag, some the clothes on their backs, and the children as well, who don't have very much at all. So what we have been doing, in addition to what we would do for any person in our shelters, is conducting a comprehensive intake to see what they need to start getting people on a path to self-sufficiency and long-term integration eventually, which is always our goal for folks, but meeting their basic needs, food, clothing, referrals for health appointments. We have a number of pregnant moms. In fact, I think we had three new babies that were born in the last week, which, you know, children are always a blessing. And helping kids to get enrolled in school, arranging for student groups to come in and do tutoring, and also doing just playing with the kids. We've got a lot of little ones that are very active. And so we quickly put together a play space with age-appropriate toys and things for the children to be able to do. You know, it is in the summer that we started our shelter in July, right after July 4th. And so, you know, there was some time when trying to keep the kids occupied before they get into school.
So then what policies would be helpful? You mentioned that 80% of those are new arrivals. What would be helpful to ease this challenge that you have in Boston?
So what I can say from our experience with these new arrivals, and, you know, we've served new arrivals here in Massachusetts, you know, for since Catholic Charities started in 1903. Of course, this situation is slightly different, as are all new arrival groups. But what policies would be very helpful is for work permits to be expedited for these newcomers. The majority of the people that we are working with are of a working age, are extremely eager to go to work, but it takes a very long time for the paperwork to be processed with the U.S. government to admit a work permit. So one of the things we would love to see if there was any type of possibility of expediting those. Obviously, policies or supports, maybe is a better word, for affordable housing. You know, Massachusetts is in a housing crisis and, you know, more housing needs to be developed. So that's a little bit more of a long-term, obviously, solution. But I would say that right now for us, the work permits are very critical.
And you mentioned children. I know that in New York, they had 21,000 new students enrolled that were not part of the regular population and expected population. Do you have similar issues with schools in Boston as well?
I wouldn't have the exact data on that. What I can say, though, is that the folks that we've been working with at our local public schools have been very receptive and come out to the shelter to help enroll the children that we are working with into schools. I certainly can imagine it's a little bit of a stress for schools to have new kids coming in, but it's been very heartwarming here in Massachusetts to see the outpouring of support and willingness to try creative methods of getting kids enrolled, such as going to shelters, you know, bringing the school enrollment staff to a shelter to help get kids into school. We've had a lot of generous support for school supplies. That was something that was definitely lacking. We've got college groups of students, you know, who are just coming back to school themselves, but they're helping out, packing up backpacks and helping to get kids ready for the school year.
Well, it sounds like you need a lot of help, so we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we go to the Diocese of El Paso, Texas. Immigration on the border through the eyes of Bishop Mark Seitz. Plus,
a controversial decision in Mexico as that country's Supreme Court makes a momentous decision about abortion.
Today, I'm giving parents this opportunity to save the life of their child and give them an opportunity to live.
The U.S. Supreme Court abortion decision in the Dobbs case sparks a renewed interest in safe haven laws. And Catholic outreach to the peripheries, the small Catholic community of Mongolia, in the spotlight of a papal visit.
Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. We continue our discussion about immigration with Bishop Mark Seitz. Bishop Seitz works on this issue every single day as the Bishop of El Paso, Texas, on the Mexican border and as the migration chair for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Bishop, it's so great to have you here. You've studied this issue. You're an expert. What leadership responsibility or advocacy role do you think the Catholic Church should be taking to ease tensions over the immigration crisis? Or are we just here for humanitarian assistance only to embrace the stranger?
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me this morning. You know, we always go from a base, which is the gospel of Jesus, and all that the church teaches, which is an elaboration, you might say, of that teaching based upon the gospel. The entire social justice doctrine, if you will, of the church, which goes through everything that we believe about the life issues, the life of the unborn, to the life of vulnerable people, is all laid out beautifully there. We have a great blessing in that teaching. And there's no way to do it that's simply focused on what happens inside a church building or even, you know, simply feeding someone. We have to be part of the conversation in this world and in a certain way be the conscience of those who are leaders of our country to call them back to these basic principles. It's not the church's job to write legislation or something like that, but we do have a responsibility to point out the fundamental teachings of Christ as they apply to the present situation.
The church definitely is supposed to be the conscience of the state, but this is such a divisive issue. There's pushback to accepting immigrants even in sanctuary cities now. Let's listen to what New York City Mayor Eric Adams said at a town hall meeting this week.
We're getting 10,000 migrants a month. 110,000 migrants. We have to feed, clothe, house, educate the children, wash their laundry sheets, give them everything they need, health care. This issue will destroy New York City. Destroy New York City.
What do you and the bishop say to those critics who say the U.S. must have enforceable laws to protect the border and limit the number of migrants who can enter?
Well, we certainly have a respect for the right of every nation to regulate crossing at the border. But that regulation shouldn't be to the point that people who are desperate have no place to turn, no place to go. This situation that we're facing right now is not really like that of past years, the 80s, 90s, when people were coming primarily to be able to work. The people that we're encountering now, very often their families, and very often they're people who were forced from their homes by the dictatorship in which they live, or by the lack of a government where they live, that leaves it open to organized crime. So we have to have some kind of response that doesn't just say, well, go die somewhere else. You know, we have to help. And one of the problems we're seeing right now is that a rather small number of cities is being challenged by the fact that people are being shipped there deliberately to overwhelm their resources. I think that's fair enough to say, without even coordinating, working with the organizations, the NGOs and the like that are there. So we could do so much better. And there are so many places in our country that could really benefit from the presence of immigrants, but we're not really working to coordinate this response.
One of those ways that the response could be coordinated is something Mayor Adams is an advocate for, which are temporary work permits to ease the economic burden. Is this something that the bishops would support?
Well, you'll hear us bishops speak very often about a broken immigration system, and that it very clearly is. It is so complex, so labyrinthine, that we really just immigrants lose on every turn. And one of the problems is that we let them come now, those who have a case to make for asylum, which is part of international law and U.S. law. But we say, sorry, folks, you need to just kind of sit on your heels for a year because we're not going to give you a work permit. So what are they supposed to do? I've never seen a group of people more willing to work, and I've never seen a situation in our country where there are so many open jobs, but we're not letting them work legally. So we create many of the problems that the mayor was referring to.
This is true. Now, Bishop Seitz, you met with President Biden, who's being criticized by his own party right now, and urged him to consider the plight of the migrant when he changed asylum policies and turned away thousands of migrants. The president is currently under fire over this issue still. What would you suggest that he do?
Well, I think that there are a number of responses, and one of the very most important ones is that we work with the sending countries, the places that are seeing migrants depart. We could help. We could do so much more. When you just think about the billions of dollars we're spending already on the border, it's like more than $20 billion. Think about what we could do if that was delivered in a way that allowed countries to have to develop a better economy, a just system, a way that people could work in safety and security in their home country. That's a right of a person, too, not to be forced from their homes, which is what's taking place now. We need more focus on the situation in the sending countries.
To help people remain in their countries. Really, really quick, do you plan to meet with him again soon?
Well, it's not the sort of thing that I can just call him up and ask for an appointment. But I'd be certainly happy to meet with him, as would our conference, to talk about these issues. We would be happy to work with anyone on any side of the aisle about ways that aren't just using these issues as political ping pong balls, but rather what are real solutions that we can begin to seek working together. That's what we need.
Well, we're grateful for your work and your advocacy. Thank you so much, Bishop Seitz.
You're welcome. God bless you.
We'll be back in a moment with top headlines from the Week in Review. Topping the news in the week in review, the Mexican Supreme Court's stunning pro-abortion decision. Justices threw out all federal criminal penalties for abortion, ruling national laws prohibiting the procedure were unconstitutional and violated women's rights and those of people with the ability to gestate. The decision extends the recent trend across Latin America of widening abortion access and tips its hat to transgender rights. Although the ruling will require the Federal Public Health Service and federal health institutions to offer abortion to anyone who requests it, abortion restrictions remain widespread. 20 of Mexico's 31 individual states still criminalize it. Mexico City, the federal district, was the first to decriminalize abortion 12 years ago. Full legalization of abortion in Mexico, should that ever happen, still must be passed state by state, though Wednesday's Supreme Court ruling makes that easier. The slow process of legalizing abortion in some states began 2 years ago when the High Court ruled abortion was not a crime in the northern state of Coahuila. The abortion issue has been the subject of massive protests in Mexico for years, with both sides taking to the streets. And in a highly religious majority Catholic country, pro-life advocates say they will continue the fight against expanded abortion access.
We will continue to lobby. Let's remember what happened in the United States. After 40 years, the Supreme Court reversed its abortion decision, and we're not going to stop until Mexico guarantees the right to life from the moment of conception.
In a three-page pastoral statement released Thursday addressing the abortion ruling, the Mexican Episcopal Conference quoted Pope Francis, who warned of those who deny protection to the unborn, the most defenseless and vulnerable, to do with them what they want, take their lives, and pass laws so no one can stop them. The statement from the conference explained the limited impact of the decision, decried violence against women and inequality, and defended the infinite value of new human life, saying it normalizes throwaway culture and removes the responsibility of those in power and of society in general of the care and protection of human life. In the same way, legalizing abortion distorts the concepts and practice of human rights and undermines the common good. Marcial Padilla, the director of Con Participación, a pro-life and pro-family nonprofit in Mexico, is here to weigh in on these developments. Marcial, thank you so much for being here. Let's go back to the beginning. When did the pro-abortion movement in Mexico really pick up momentum? And where does the financial support for them come from?
Yeah, I like to call those movements anti-life more than pro-abortion, because they go against life in general. Those groups have their roots in the era of sexual revolution, but their specific work to impose abortion in Mexico began in the 90s. It is important to mention that they have modified their strategies because they believed that millions of women were going to support them, and it didn't happen. Actually, in reality, people were not so founded to legalize abortion. So they are trying to impose abortion through lawsuits against the government, through the Supreme Court of Mexico, precisely because there is no popular support to do it through Congress or a referendum. In this space, I could mention four of these organizations. The first one is a Group for Chosen Reproduction, or GIRE in Spanish. Mm-hmm. It was founded in 1992, and which is the abortion organization that is filing lawsuits against the government to legalize abortion. There is also IPAS, IPAS, an international organization with a subsidiary in Mexico. The current president of the National Women's Institute was the director of IPAS Mexico. Another organization is MEXFAM, a subsidiary of Planned Parenthood in Mexico. Planned Parenthood financial reports say that they have sent hundreds of thousands of dollars to promote abortion through MEXFAM. Another organization is Fondo Semillas, which received private money from the United States with these funds, they have distributed chemical abortion drugs in Mexico near the border with California. And since then, these organizations have had funding from abroad to promote the legalization of abortion. And they have modified their strategies, as I have mentioned.
Right. And many pro-abortion groups in Latin America say that this is a solution to femicide, to domestic abuse, and to years of cultural machismo. And the Mexican bishops in their statement opposing the decision also decried the systemic violence against women as deplorable and affirming it should be excluded from Mexican culture to create norms and laws that are truly just. What is the pro-life response to this? It's not abortion.
Well, of course not. It is a false dilemma to contrast mother and son as if they were enemies. In reality, the dignity of the women and the child is equal, and the love for both is the only way that as individuals, as family, and as society, we should go through. The only fair and reasonable thing to do is equally love, respect, and protect both pregnant women and their unborn child. In Mexico, of course, there are big, really, really big problems related to respect for women. These problems have to be resolved with a logic of life. It is unacceptable, totally unacceptable, to use the violence of abortion to try to solve the violence of machismo, the violence of murder of women, or the violence in home, domestic violence. The pro-life answer is an answer that changes everything by changing one word. Instead of using the word or, let's use the word and. Let's not think either the woman or the life of the children, but think the women and the life of the children both have to be respected and protected.
Now, Marcial, EWTN News has covered pro-abortion movements in Latin America before, like the Green Scarf Movement that comes from Argentina and has headquarters on the U.S.-Mexico border. Why should Catholics outside of Mexico care about this decision?
Well, it is important because if we see that something is happening in another Latin American country, eventually it's going to happen in yours too. Actually, as we speak, we are seeing more or less the same process in Ecuador, where the current government and some pro-anti-life and pro-abortion organizations in Ecuador are suing the government the same way they are doing this in Mexico, and they are trying to do so in their own countries. We need to protect both lives of the women and the children using the new strategies and achieving the result that both in the law but also in society there is not popular support enough to make these laws to really hold on the social heart of the people. Besides that, Mexico is always has always been seen as an experimental place for many of these cultural transformations. And I don't know if this counts too, but in Mexico we have Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yes.
And maybe there's a specific, goal to use Mexico as this place where Our Lady has show so much love to disrespect and despise life. I don't know why.
No, that's true. That's true. Our Lady plays an important role, and it's important to rely on her in these moments of crisis. Well, thank you so much for your work, Marcial. We really hope to have you back.
Sure.
A frank and sincere dialogue. That is how the two-hour meeting between Pope Francis and the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Synod of Bishops was described by their leader, Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk. The bishops are gathered in Rome for their annual synod this week, not to be confused with the Synod on Synodality General Assembly being held this October. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is the largest of the 23 Eastern Catholic churches in communion with Rome. The leader of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church expressed his concern that the Holy Father's recent statements on Russia have been painful for the Ukrainian people.
At the end of August, in a video conference meeting with young Russian Catholics, Pope Francis spoke in off-the-cuff remarks to the Russian youth about the need to embrace their culture, to embrace their Russian heritage. referenced Great Mother Russia, and he referenced certain Russian czars who spread the Russian Empire in the past. So some of these comments were taken then subsequently by Ukrainian Catholics as the Pope supporting or promoting the idea of Russian imperialism. Pope Francis, he referenced those remarks. And he explained that he did not mean to promote any kind of Russian imperialism. What he was merely doing was defending the good parts of the culture of Russia.
The Pope went on to say that he was sorry if his words implied he was defending Russia's aggression against Ukraine. During the meeting, Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk gave Francis a prayer book, a rosary, and a missionary cross belonging to two Redemptorist priests captured by Russian troops in November of 2022. The theme of this year's Synod of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is pastoral support for victims of war. Eastern churches are governed by these synods, during which time they can discuss the direction their church is headed and elect new bishops. Despite Eastern church autonomy, they still remain loyal to the Holy See. This synod wraps up next week. Turning now to the Synod on Synodality, the first of two assemblies with Catholic clergy and laity from around the world kicks off this October. Women are at the center of two different issues. First, the role women have in this synod, including their new ability to vote. The other issue is the role women have as leaders in the church, with potential discussions on allowing women to become deacons.
I think we have a clear, even from the Pope's statements and Pope Benedict before him, we have no real reason so far to consider that the doctrine will be at risk, especially considering priesthood for women or diaconate for women. Of course, there will be some divides. It's true that some people are pushing this agenda. People have share these views, and they will try to introduce these ideas, and it will be probably put. It will be part of the debates, but so far there is no sign that it will be part. It will be on the agenda to change any part of the doctrine from that point of view.
Pope Francis himself was on the record this week explaining his view on the Synod on Synodality as he returned from his papal visit to Asia.
Do you know what's happening today?
Yeah, I think it's Pope is coming in Mongolia.
Do you know anything about the Pope?
No.
No?
Yeah.
But you think this is exciting?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I want to see one of the greatest men in the world.
Wow.
Impact and impressions. Our Colin Flynn brings us important moments from the Pope's trip to Mongolia when we return.
The Synod is dialogue among the baptized, among the members of the Church, about the life of the Church, about dialogue with the world, about the problems that affect humanity today.
Pope Francis comments on the upcoming Synod on Synodality in a news conference on his papal plane as he concludes a successful trip to Mongolia earlier this week. He called the October assembly a prayerful dialogue free of ideology, not full of political chatter. The Pope was repeatedly asked about the upcoming synod, as well as tensions between the Church and Mongolia's two powerful neighbors, Russia and China. This as he expressed satisfaction with his trip to the small Catholic community within Mongolia. Our Colin Flynn brings us some of the highlights of the latest papal foreign visit.
It's been almost 800 years since King Genghis Khan wrote to Pope Innocent IV at the Vatican demanding his submission. And now Pope Francis will become the first pope in history to visit Mongolia. And even before he landed, he was already making headlines. As Pope Francis's plane made the 10-hour journey from Rome to Ulaanbaatar, it passed through Chinese airspace. In the past, Beijing has refused Pope's permission to use Chinese airspace, but on this occasion, they allowed. And as is Vatican protocol, the Pope sent a telegram to President Xi Jinping, wishing goodwill to him and the people of China. He also said he was praying for peace and unity. The following day, the Chinese foreign minister responded, saying it displayed goodwill and kindness, and that they were committed to continuing to walk together. In front of the presidential palace in the capital of the city, Mongolian guards on horseback led the official opening ceremony as President Ukyagin Kuryasuk welcomed the Pope to the country. A small crowd gathered in the square, incredibly only a few hundred. This was not going to be a papal trip with thousands of people lining the streets, but one of the most low-key Pope Francis has ever embarked on. But those who gathered were enthusiastic.
Thank you so much for coming to Mongolia. I'm so grateful, really honored to be part of here.
I'm excited that a church leader could take such an interest in the small and the dispossessed, in a sense.
And also in the crowd, but keeping a lower key, shielding their faces, were people from China. They told reporters that they had come from mainland China, but were frightened to reveal their identities. There had been reports that some Chinese bishops and faithful were forbidden from traveling to Mongolia for the papal visit. In his opening speech, Pope Francis praised the ancient Mongol Empire and its leader, Genghis Khan, noting the, quote, ability of your ancestors to acknowledge the outstanding qualities of the peoples in this immense territory and to put those qualities at the service of the common development, end quote. This was met with a certain amount of backlash online as some historians pointed out that Genghis Khan and his armies killed tens of millions of people. The following day, Pope Francis paid a visit to the country's only cathedral, St. Peter's and St. Paul's, where he met with almost all of the country's 80 religious priests and nuns, encouraging them in their mission. Outside, a small crowd had gathered, including again some Chinese. One 30-year-old Chinese man who travelled to Mongolia alone to see the Pope agreed to speak to me on camera in the condition that we ask just a few simple questions about why he was there.
I want to see the Pope. He's the representative of the Jesus in the world.
And if you had a chance to meet Pope Francis, what would you say to him?
I will cry. I can't say anything, to be honest.
When I asked him if he was worried about visiting Mongolia to see the Pope and the possible repercussions, he said he wasn't.
Making the journey here.
I never worry about that, because the Catholic is for the whole world.
So you think your faith is more important?
Yes, exactly.
Maria Alejandra and her mother flew all the way from Peru just to try and be close to the Pope.
How long did it take to get here?
Like 2 days.
2 days to travel all the way here?
Yes, all the way here. Only for 2 days, only for the Pope.
For them, their tenacity paid off. When waiting outside the bishop's residence where the Pope was staying, they got to meet the Holy Father for a brief moment. Mongolia is 52% Buddhist, and later that day at the Hun Theatre, constructed in the shape and style of a traditional Mongolian gear, the Pope held an interreligious meeting with members of various faith groups present in Mongolia.
Buongiorno a tutti voi.
In his speech, the Pope praised Mongolia's wisdom that its various religions have contributed to. He noted the various faiths have something in common, that they have a commitment to justice and peace, and said that the fact that they were all sitting together was a sign of hope.
Bringing more people here, bringing more prosperity, and bringing up the Mongolian people, you know, with the faith that they already have, the Buddhism, etc., and put him in the center like any other country.
It's indeed very important and warmest visiting Mongolia, Pope Francisco's visit.
The largest event Pope Francis took part in was the celebration of Mass on Sunday evening in the country's Step Arena, with a crowd of around 2,500 people. Inside the arena, there were more Chinese flags, many from Vietnam and members of the small 1,500 community of Catholics in Mongolia.
Superstar.
Last week on EWTN News in Depth, we met the Augustina family, who converted to the Catholic Church a number of years ago. They were sitting proudly in the arena, getting ready to celebrate Mass with the Holy Father.
We are so happy to welcome the Pope in our country. It's beautiful.
In his homily, the Pope spoke eloquently about the values that the Christian faith has. He said, quote, "You don't need to be famous, rich, or powerful to be happy. Only love satisfies our heart's thirst, and the Christian faith is the answer to that thirst," end quote. At the end of the Mass, he spoke off the cuff, introducing two bishops who were in attendance from Hong Kong. And finishing, he told the Chinese Catholics present to go and be good Christians and also good citizens.
Well, this was a papal trip that, even though it was to Mongolia, started with China, the Pope sending that telegram from the plane to Xi Jinping, and then ended with China, the Pope telling the faithful Chinese that were here to go on and be good Christians, but also good citizens. The Vatican is hoping that this historic trip will have a profound effect on the church here in Mongolia, but perhaps more importantly, on its two big neighbouring countries. In Ulaanbaatar, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Our thanks to our entire EWTN news team, television, print, and digital, for their continuing coverage of the Pope's trips around the globe.
I will raise this baby with all the love that I can, and thank you for making this amazing, brave choice.
When we come back, we'll tell you about successful efforts to save the lives of children, one baby at a time.
In the past year, since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, there has been an increased interest in safe haven laws, which allow the surrender of newborns to an emergency infant care provider. Just this past week, a Texas law went into effect permitting the use of baby box drop-offs to safely allow a mother in crisis to transfer her child legally and without question to the authorities. Reporter Rizal Regis tells us there's a network of people across the country supporting these safe haven laws.
Meet Porter.
He's 12 years old. He's super active, plays sports, chess club, Boy Scouts.
12 years ago, Porter became an unexpected blessing for the Olsen family. Nicole Olsen and her husband Michael had their first son, Paul, but they were longing for another child.
Well, my husband and I were, you know, actively trying to get pregnant, and it just wasn't working. We reached out to some adoption agencies.
After years of waiting, a phone call changed their life. They were going to have a baby that same day.
And one day we just got a call that there was a baby and that the baby had been already born. All of the things that happens at once. So I remember we went to Target. We had four carts and we're just putting everything in, you know, just getting ready for baby to come home.
That baby is Porter. Porter's birth mother placed him in a baby box at a hospital through what's called safe haven laws. Safe haven laws allow mothers to surrender their baby in designated locations shortly after giving birth without fear of being charged with a crime.
My oldest son, Paul, prayed to have a baby brother. We were up to either one, but he was so happy that he got his brother.
Olsen explains there were a lot of unknowns, such as when or where the baby was born, the baby's ethnicity, details of parents, or any medical history. However, she takes comfort in knowing that this baby was saved by his birth mother and was placed in their loving home. The Olsen family is now complete with baby Porter.
I really wanted to connect with the birth mom. I wanted to say, I'm going to love your child forever. You know, you have blessed us. You made a beautiful decision. That's the bravest thing I can ever imagine.
Every state has a safe haven law, but laws vary from state to state. Safe haven laws drew national attention after two U.S. Supreme Court justices cited these laws as an alternative to abortion during oral arguments in the case Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. As a result, the National Safe Haven Alliance saw an uptick of people calling for more information.
When the Dobbs decision actually came out, that month we had a 300% increase in calls. And then after that, we kind of, you know, calmed down a little bit and things have settled right around that. But we are definitely seeing an increased call volume, I think, because there's been awareness brought to Safe Haven.
Heather Berner is the executive director of the National Safe Haven Alliance. The organization supports parents facing unplanned pregnancies by promoting safe haven laws and providing necessary resources. It runs a 24/7 crisis helpline where a trained crisis response team made of social workers and nurses can help talk callers through different options and work towards a plan that best fits the caller.
When they reach out and connect, we can often identify where is this crisis. The crisis is often not the baby. The crisis is their life. What's happening? What circumstances surrounded this? More than 115 babies were saved last year. And we are looking at approximately 40 to 42 babies that I know of this year.
According to the organization, about 4,400 babies have been saved since the first law took effect in 1999. There's also been a recent push to expand safe haven laws in several states. One example is Virginia, where the state legislature passed four bills to extend the 14-day surrender period to up to 30 days and allow for infants to be surrendered to either emergency medical services personnel or a newborn safety box staffed by an emergency medical services agency. Similar proposals are being considered in other states like Alabama and Georgia. Just this week in Texas, the governor signed a bill into law that allows the use of baby boxes to surrender a newborn. Another organization on the forefront of preventing baby abandonments is Safe Haven Baby Boxes.
The baby box is a device that is installed in the side of firehouses and hospitals, and the box calls 911 on its own.
Founder of Safe Haven Baby Boxes, Monica Kelsey, says her organization offers an anonymous option for parents to surrender their babies.
We need to make sure that they know every single option that's available to them so that they can make the best choice for themselves.
The first baby box was installed in Indiana in 2016. Now there are 157 active baby boxes in 11 states. According to the organization, close to 40 babies have been surrendered directly at Safe Haven Baby Box locations.
We're averaging right now a baby every 10 days in our boxes, somewhere in America. So the word is getting out. Women are utilizing the resources. They're calling us and getting counseling after the fact. And the program is working.
Kelsey says they have been steadily adding more boxes nationwide, and she expects the numbers to continue to grow. Both Berner and Kelsey hope to spread more awareness of safe haven laws, despite pushback from critics.
No matter how people are talking about it, they're bringing awareness to the law. And the law exists to help and prevent these babies from being left in dangerous locations. We shouldn't use it for anything else other than that, because we really want to support families the best way possible.
We're just going to continue to keep working to save the lives of these infants that are destined to be abandoned, regardless of what the state statute says about abortion.
Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
There's much more to discuss about safe haven laws. Next week on EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, host Prudence Robertson speaks with the founder of the organization, A Safe Haven for Newborns, which has helped thousands of women throughout the state of Florida. That's next Thursday, September 14th at 10 p.m. Eastern. Finally today, who doesn't need a little more happiness in their life? A new book is coming out next week about increasing the joy in your life. It's co-authored by Oprah Winfrey and Harvard Business School professor Arthur Brooks, who recently sat down with me to talk about his Catholic faith. During that conversation, he shared a little insight into his new book.
It's a how-to manual on emotional self-management, and then the key to understanding how you can build the pillars of the happiest possible life and build that life step by step by step. It's kind of like the owner's manual in the glove compartment of your car, but for you,
oh,
for your own happiness.
That's great.
Yeah.
How does your faith play a part in what you wrote and how you shared that with Oprah?
Well, my faith is infused in everything I do. The reason I study happiness, the reason I teach happiness, the reason I talk about happiness is because I want a happier world. And the source of my joy is my Catholic faith. Oprah practices the Christian faith as well. Mm. And so the result is we actually have a big part of the book on faith and spirituality. And we talk about the neuroscience about how faith actually affects your brain and gives you experiences neurophysiologically that you can't access otherwise. No joke. There's a problem. Atheism is a problem in the way that you can actually access the kind of experiences that you need to be happy. So we give all the data on that. We give the evidence on that. We also talk about how you know, faith can help solve mood disorders, anxiety, depression. There's so many ways that it enriches our lives.
The book comes out September 12th. It's called The Art and Science of Getting Happier. Build the Life You Want. You can catch my full interview with Arthur Brooks on the EWTN YouTube page. That's EWTN Catholic TV on YouTube. And that's this week's edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. We look forward to seeing you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.